the locality. Param?
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, good. So, I welcome everybody, and thank you for the opportunity to give this talk. So I'm going to talk about new work done in collaboration, done with the Gang of Four, in collaboration with Liz Molin here, and Giovanni Emilino Camellia, and Jerzy Kowalski-Glickman. It's based on one paper, which is already out, and hopefully there will be two or three more papers coming out very soon along the same line. So next slide, first slide. So the work starts from a simple and very fundamental question, which is, in fact, what do we really see around us? What do you really see? What do you really experience when you look around? Do you see space? If you think about it, in fact, we don't see space because the speed of light is finite. Therefore, the light we see from distant objects is coming from, you know, some time ago. So what we think we see is that we see space-time. But in fact, do you really experience living, you know, in a space-time? Do you really have access to what a point of space is or what a moment of time is? And next slide. In fact, no. We know that this is not what we directly experience. What we directly experience is, in fact, energy and momentum space. What we directly experience is exchange of quanta or emission. You know, we receive photons, we emit photons, we see photon riding with different momentum and energy at different angles. So as naive observers, but also as more advanced observers in particle physicists at the NHC, what we really observe are not directly space-time points. What we really observe are measurements about energy and momentum of the quanta we absorb and emit. So there's, you know, we don't really have a grasp or a direct grasp of events which are microscopically displaced from us. So this is the framework or the type of questions we're going to investigate, giving up, in some sense, the idea that physics really happened in space-time. And if you think about it, there is an invariant a scene for where physics happens, but this is not really space-time. This is phase-space. Physics happened at the quantum level in Hilbert space, at a classical level in phase-space. And space-time is a kind of projection from phase-space. It's a Lagrange, you know, technically it's a Lagrange for manifold. But we don't have to assume that this projection from space-time is a trivial projection. Next slide. So, in fact, when we say that we see momentum space, we do reconstruct or infer a notion of space-time, but the notion of space-time is really reconstructed or inferred from a measurement of energy and momentum. This is essentially Einstein procedures of synchronization of clocks and distance localization. That is, you know, observers send photons that bounce back to other, you know, distant observers, and then what we measure are really the proper time elapsed between these photons which are sent and received from different directions. Now, there is one fundamental hypothesis that pervades all of physics up to now, and sometimes, and this is the hypothesis we want to question. The fundamental hypothesis is that when we do the Einstein localization procedure or synchronization of clock, then we assume that the energy of the probe we use is totally inessential. When we think about space-time, you know, we assume that the universe we see in blue light or in red light or in gamma ray is the same space-time. It's totally independent on the, you know, energy of the probe, the type of energy we use. And this is what we call the absolute locality hypothesis. And this is this fundamental absolute locality hypothesis that we want to question. We want to ask why this hypothesis is true. Is it possible that this is only an hypothesis? This is really a truth of nature. Maybe, you know, we know this hypothesis works very well. It has worked very well for us up to now. So The question is more, you know, is this hypothesis just a low energy approximation? And what happens if we, you know, relax that type of hypothesis? So what we're going to see, now I want to move more into how are we going to be able to relax this absolute locality hypothesis? Where is it really made? One of the main points of the talk is to show that, in fact, this absolute locality hypothesis, the hypothesis that, you know, the notion of space-time is totally independent on the type of observer. That's what I mean, you know, the type of energy we look at, or that observers which are distant related, which are microscopically displaced from each other, exactly reconstruct the same space-time. So this hypothesis about absolute locality is in fact equivalent to the assumption that energy and momentum space is a linear manifold. That is, it's a manifold which is a vector space. It has a flat metric, and it has a flat connection. So what it amounts to here is that the notion of absolute locality is related, this hypothesis of absolute locality is related to the hypothesis about the geometry of momentum space. So I want to turn around the usual logic. The usual logic is that there exists a space-time, therefore momentum space is something that we derive. And when we derive momentum space from space-time, momentum space appears to be some type of cotangent bundle. And therefore, it's a plane. It's a vector space. Therefore, it is linear, and, you know, we don't question its geometry. But the point I want to make here is that if we take the point of view that, in fact, momentum space is the fundamental object, and that space-time is, in fact, reconstructed from momentum space measurements, now we have the freedom to ask the question about the geometry of momentum space. What happens if, in fact, momentum space is not a linear manifold? If it's not a linear manifold, what we're changing is really the notion that there exists a universal space-time. There is an absolute notion of space-time where, you know, we can define locality. So this is really the question we want to investigate here. What if momentum space is a nonlinear manifold? What type of space-time do we reconstruct using this Einstein localization procedure? Do we really infer all the same space-time? Do we still infer the same space-time at different energy? And how do we do it? So we see here that by taking this new perspective on the geometry of momentum space, we now have the possibility to relax this absolute locality hypothesis in a controlled manner. What we're going to do is we're going to allow the possibility for momentum space to be a nonlinear manifold. And this allow us to propose a framework in which locality is relaxed in a controlled manner, in a very specific and controlled manner. And, you know, it goes back to this idea that physics happens in space. Now, what could be the motivation of such a proposal? Why would we like to, you know, even touch on this idea that space-time exists or the notion of locality? And of course, here it's an easy sell in this audience because the deep motivation behind all this work is quantum gravity. We all know that at some fundamental level, when quantum gravity is turned on, the notion of space-time or the notion of locality is going to dissolve in a certain manner. So, you know, we want to be able to face that possibility. We want to be able to develop a framework which allow us to investigate what happens when we relax this notion of locality. So behind the motivation is really quantum gravity. So to be more specific, I haven't said next slide and next slide. Sorry. You remind me. Have you followed the slide?
Just say which slide are you on?
There was a slide, absolute locality, and then quantum gravity limit.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay, sorry about that. So here, okay, so we propose a framework in which, you know, we want to relax in a controlled manner the notion of locality. And as I say, the motivation is quantum gravity. We are not, you know, we are not going to do quantum gravity, and in fact we want to work in a regime in this talk where both, in some sense, quantum mechanics and gravitations are turned off. So we want to work in a regime where H bar and G Newton are neglected, in a regime where both H bar and G Newton are sent to zero. However, we want to keep the ratio H bar over G Newton fixed. The ratio H bar over G Newton is the Planck mass square. So in this limit, where we neglect quantum mechanics and we neglect quantum gravity, we want to keep one fundamental scale, which is a mass scale. So in this limit, and you know, if we have a theory of quantum gravity, there will always be a regime of probing this theory of quantum gravity where we also are going to be able to probe this the sector of the theory. So this is, for the purpose of the talk, this is where I'm going to stay. So now that there is this fundamental scale, in fact, there is the possibility of introducing non-linearity in momentum space, and you know, the existence of such a fundamental scale, which is the Planck scale, allow us to expect that there will be a deformation of momentum space. Note that this limit, when we send H bar and G goes to zero, the Planck length goes to zero. So there is no fundamental discreteness or fundamental non-locality which are left over from quantum gravity. We're really in a limit where LP goes to zero, but the Planck mass is L6. Next slide. So now let's go and dig a bit deeper before going into the model, and bear with me for a moment. Let's go and dig a bit deeper about the meaning of the geometry of momentum space. So if we take the point of view that, in fact, what we really see and we really measure are, you know, momentum space, and we take an operational point of view, we imagine an observer, some type of local observer equipped with a calorimeter and a clock. Then such an observer will, you know, assign conserved quantity to individual particles, which, and these conserved quantities are going to be our definition of momentum space. Now, such an observer can realize two types of measurements. She can realize, you know, one particle measurement, which are essentially measurements of the mass of particles or kinetic energy of these particles. She can also realize multi-particle measurements, which are going to be, you know, involving scattering processes, interactions, merging, all these phenomena. Next slide. So if we focus on the single particle measurements, measurements we do on you know, one particle system, then the single particle measurements for us are going to determine the geometry of momentum space. So in our context, we postulate in some sense that momentum space is a Lorentzian manifold, so this is a Lorentzian metric. Momentum space also has a distinct point. When I say momentum space, I really mean the relativistic momentum space, that is energy in momentum space. And of course, if I take a point which has zero energy and zero momenta, this is a vacuum state of the theory, and nothing happens there. And if I add the vacuum, I add nothing. So there is a special point in momentum space, which is this vacuum state, which we call the origin zero. Okay. So now the mass, if we think about what is the mass, in you know, how we define a mass is an invariant quantity. That is, it can be defined as a time-like distance of my point in momentum space, p, from the origin. This is what the equation is saying here, that the mass square is essentially the distance square of p from the origin. And this is a time-like distance. If you think a bit more about it, you can also see that the kinetic energy, in fact, can be used as a definition of the space-like distance between two particles. That is, if we take two particles, one at rest, one moving, and they are of identical mass, the distance square between these two particles, which is now a space-like distance, is essentially the kinetic energy k up to a factor minus 2m, where m is the common mass of this particle. So from this single particle measurement, if we don't assume, and the whole setting here is that we don't assume any a priori things about momentum space, except that we can do this fundamental operation. So from the measurements of single particle dynamics, we can reconstruct a metric on momentum space. So what we can deduce is that the existence of mass and kinetic energy, you know, leads us to the notion that there exists a metric in momentum space. Next slide. Here there's a very important point that we have to keep in mind, is that when we define, you know, momentum space operationally like that, and we don't assume that there's a preferred coordinate or preferred notion of linearity in momentum space, then we have to use one type of calorimeter. But of course, we can use another type of calorimeter with another brand of calorimeter. And changing calorimeters amounts to change labeling of what we call momentum space. And in fact, it amounts essentially to make a diffeomorphism, you know, on momentum space. And of course, physics has to be independent of this notion of momentum space diffeomorphism. So we're going to, you know, use the fact that the observable we're going to see has to be, you know, invariant under diffeomorphism on this momentum space. That is invariant under the regauging of our calorimeter. We have seen what is the geometry coming from single particle measurements. Now, let's turn on the interaction. So if we have interactions, if we look at what happens when we have multiparticles, we need in order to define interactions, we need the fact that there exists a rule to combine momenta. That is, if we have two systems, particle one, particle two, there is a rule that... Next slide. So, you know, for multi-particle processes, we need to have a rule to compose momentum. So what it means is that we have a rule, which is expressed here, that if you start from two momenta, P and Q, then it's possible to construct a new momentum, which is defined by this O plus addition, P plus QA, okay? So we have to postulate that there is a way to merge together two momenta and to create a new a combined conserved momentum, okay? So now more complicated interactions processes are built up by interactions of decomposition. So if we have a trivalent interaction, it's going to be essentially expressing the fact that the sum of the three momenta is, vanish at the place of interaction. Now here I put, when I write P plus Q plus K with this O plus P, with this O plus addition, I put parentheses because at this stage we don't want to assume anything about this rule of addition. That is, we don't want to assume that this rule of addition is linear, and we don't assume that. We don't assume also that it is commutative or that it is associative, and we want to explore what are the consequences of this property. Next property we need to have is that, you know, we need to turn ingoing momenta into outgoing momenta, or we need to be able to put something in a system and extract something in a system. So we need a notion of inversion or subtraction, okay? And so we postulate that there is a rule of subtraction, which is compatible with the rule of addition in the sense that minus P plus K with the parenthesis is also equal to K. And this defines this general structure is called in the mathematical literature left loops. And it was developed some time ago by Kakiwa and Sabinin, Japanese mathematician and a Russian mathematician. But I also developed this structure a bit more. Okay, so this is the next slide. So far we have some kind of algebra, you know, of algebraic rule of combining momenta. The important thing is that if we go back to this idea that, in fact, you know, momentum space is a manifold and there's a structure and there's a diffeomorphism symmetry, we can look at how the rule of addition, there's a natural way in which under which the rule of addition transforms under diffeomorphism. So if we use this way of transformation of additional rule on the diffeomorphism, very natural to try to first construct, not only to not look only at the rule of addition, but to construct this object which I call U of P, which is essentially the derivative of the addition P plus Q with respect to Q, and then putting Q equal to zero. Okay, so it's like I take an infinitesimal addition. I look of the property of what it means to add to P some infinitesimal, and it gives me a linear operator UP. And it's possible to see that, in fact, this operator transforms as a map from the tangent space of the momentum space at zero, at the identity, to the tangent space of momentum space at P. So this linear map maps a vector above the identity to a vector above P. And in fact, you know, this is suggestive of what we usually call in physics and mathematics a parallel transport operator. And in fact, you know, it is a parallel transport operator. It can be interpreted as a parallel transport operator, but it also transforms as a parallel transport operator. In order for it to be really a parallel transport operator, we need one additional hypothesis on this rule of addition, which is called monoalternicity. Essentially, it's essentially the property that if I add to itself a momentum, if I add the same momentum again and again and again and again and again, then the rule of composition has to be associative with respect to this type of addition of the same element. It's a technical condition, but it has some physical interpretation. But I don't want to dwell too much into it. Next slide. So let me dig a bit deeper of the reason why, you know, here if you see the sheet, what I'm doing is that I'm trading somehow some algebraic notion of addition towards some more geometric notion of parallel transport and eventually connection. So how can this be, you know, what is the relationship between, you know, type of affine geometry, connection and addition? So one way to think about that is that you can think about this rule of addition. If you have a momentum space, and suppose that on this momentum space we have a notion of connection, we can think about this rule of addition as a rule of combining geodesics on the curve manifold. That is, suppose that you have a geodesics, the little drawing shows a geodesics going from 0 to P, and it shows as a straight line, but you know, if it's a curve manifold, it should be a curved line there. And then there's another geodesic which is going from 0 to K. So these are my two momentum. So I use the fact that there is a special point in my manifold, so I can, you know, interpret the point P and the point K as in fact geodesic from going from 0 to P and 0 to K. Now I can, if I have a connection, I can take the geodesic. I mean, in other, if I have a connection, I can define the notion of geodesics. And if I have a connection, I can also parallel transport P, the geodesic P, along the geodesic K, and define the endpoint of this parallel transport as my rule of addition, K plus Q. So this is, in some sense, the reason why you see a rule of addition. If I take now P to be an infinitesimal, it's easy to see that K plus DPA is just, you know, K plus the, I mean, K O plus DPA is K plus DPA plus, you know, the parallel transport of DP. So I hope this is clear that in fact, you know, there's a natural geometrical relationship between the notion of motion in an affine manifold, parallel transport, and the rule of addition. Okay, to be Next slide. So to be more precise, what, you know, we are saying here is that the composition rule defines, in fact, an affine connection on momentum space. And the way to see it is that if I take this rule of addition P plus Q, and I take the derivative with respect to P and the derivative with respect to Q, and I put both at zero, I get an object which carries the same index as a affine connection index, and it's also transformed on the diffeomorphism as an affine connection. This is going to be the affine connection derived from the from the rule of addition here evaluated by the identity. Now we see that if the rule of addition is non-commutative, and I take the difference between the p plus q and q plus p, then what I get is the torsion operator, which is the difference of the anti-symmetric part of the connection. So the torsion of this connection measures the amount of non-commutativity of my rule of addition. What about associativity then? Next slide. So what we can show is that, in fact, if I compute now the lack of associativity of my rule of composition, this amounts to computing the curvature of the connection. So we can assign, so the notion of non-associativity, which is very scary in some sense from the point of view of algebraic rules, is very natural from the point of view of connection, because it's really just the idea or the fact that the connection has its curvature. Now here, you know, we construct the connection, the torsion, the curvature at the identity. So we can do the same thing, and we can construct all these objects at all the points in the momentum space. No, not yet. We can construct all these objects in the at different point in momentum space by translating away from zero using the left translation operator that we call LK of P, which is just essentially adding K on the left to P. So there's a way to define the notion of curvature and torsion on the whole manifold. Next slide. So now I want to talk about the dynamic, but let me pause for a moment. So here, what I've said so far, I've studied the geometry of momentum space, and I've said that there is naturally a notion of a metric on momentum space, and which is given by, in some sense, kinematics of, you know, a single particle. But there's also a notion of connection on momentum space, a fine connection, which is defined by the notion of interaction. And the whole theory has to be default invariant, which means that observable quantities are going to be expressible and constructed from tensors. And there is three fundamental tensors that characterize the geometry of momentum space. The first one is the curvature of the affine connection, which measures non-associativity of the rule. The second one is the torsion of the affine connection that measures the non-commutativity of the addition rule. And the third one is the non-metricity, that is, we don't have to assume necessarily that the connection, the affine connection on momentum space, is metrical. It preserves the metric. So if it doesn't preserve the metric, there would be a tensor, which is the non-metricity tensor. And these three tensors are going to play a key role in the experimental test of our proposal. So keep them in mind. Next, so we are here on the dynamic side. So, you know, the point of this study is that we want to claim that space-time emerged from the dynamics on momentum space. And this is now, we are going to construct a model where we explicitly show how this happens. So we are in a limit where we study classical particle dynamics. H bar is turned on. So which means that we're looking at classical processes of particles coming in and coming out and interacting. And for each physical processes, we can draw a diagram, which is more or less, you know, what people call a Feynman diagram, which is a diagram of interactions containing incoming lines and vertices and outgoing lines. Now, given such a process and given such a diagram, we can assign a classical action determining the dynamics of a relativistic particle associated with this process. And the dynamics is built up with two parts. One part is the free action for a particle propagating along a line. And then there is also interaction action for particle interacting at the vertex. And we should have one free action for every line of the diagram, and one interaction action for every vertices of the diagram. Next slide. So let's look first at the free action. So if we look at the free particle dynamics, in order to write the free particle dynamics, we first need to introduce the notion of we're living in momentum space, so we need to have a notion of the momentum of momenta that we call XA. So XA is the particle conjugated to the momentum KA, and it enters the action in the form XA KA dot. And then the relativistic dynamics is usually imposed by imposing, is usually realized by imposing the Mach-Shell constraint, the fact that K square is equal to M square in the usual case. So in our case, we introduce a Lagrange multiplier and then a Mach-Shell constraint CK. But now CK is not just K square minus M square, but it's essentially a constraint that tells us that the distance from the origin, d square of k, is equal to the mass square. Okay, so the change here is that we use the metric to define the Mach-Shell constraint. The important point here, if you spend some time looking at this action, is that the free particle action makes absolutely no reference to a metric on space-time. The contraction between x and k, you know, is a contraction between a vector and a covector. No metric is needed. And the dynamics of relativistic particle, in fact, what you need to write down the dynamics of relativistic particle in this first order formalism is a metric on momentum space, not a metric on space-time. So the notion of space-time geometry is really inferred from this metric in momentum space. In the usual case, we have the usual same three relativistic action. The only difference is that now the metric is flat and the distance square is just k0 square minus vector k square. Next slide. If we look at the equation of motion of this world line action, the free action, then if we vary x, we get that the momentum has to be conserved. The momentum is a conserved quantity. That's the first equation. We get another equation varying the Lagrange multiplier n that the constraint has to be satisfied, ck is equal to zero, so the distance squared is the mass. And then if we vary k, we get a bulk equation of motion that essentially says that the velocity of x dot of a, is proportional to the variation of c with respect to k. Okay, so it's proportional to some combination of the momentum. Now, there's a very important point that we are free to choose different coordinates in momentum space. And there is one coordinate where it's very convenient to work with. This is the Riemann normal coordinate. So we have a special origin point here. And the constraint is expressed as the distance from this origin. Now, in a neighborhood of this origin, it's always possible to choose Riemann normal coordinates.
Sorry, I have a question, if that's okay.
Yes.
I'm just wondering. So, what you have in the action, you have k dot, right? So, what is the dot? Is a derivative with respect to what? Because right now, it's not clear that you have a time or anything. You don't have a space time.
Okay, let's go back. That's an important point. Let's go back to the previous action. In order to write down this action, I should have said that. This action is an integral from minus infinity to zero, because I imagine that the particle is incoming, and at zero there is some interaction arising. And the integral is over a proper time assigned to the world line of particles. So initially I said that every observer has a calorimeter and a clock. So in order to define this world line action, we need to assign a notion of proper time for each particle moving in space-time. So this is really this proper time that I'm using here. Okay? Is that clear?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. So let's go back to the next slide entitled the world line action. So what I wanted to say is that the velocity with respect to this proper time. And of course, you know, the proper time, you know, is going to be fixed by, let's say, choosing the lapse. So if I fix the lapse equal a constant on the world line, then this amount is to take the usual, invariant distance or usual proper time notion. So what I see, What I was saying is that there exists, because we have a special origin and the constraint is essentially different from this origin, we can choose special coordinates there, which are the Riemann normal coordinates. The amazing thing about Riemann normal coordinates is that, in fact, these are coordinates where the distance from the origin has exactly the same form as in the flat case. So in Riemann coordinates, the constraint Ck is exactly of the form k0 square minus ki square. So if we use this Riemann normal coordinate, we see that in fact x dot is just proportional to k. And then the usual relation of relativistic particles. Okay, next slide. So this was the free part of the action. Now we need to impose interaction. The interaction in this context is essentially given by imposing the conservation law. So what we have is that at a vertex, we have, let's say, three momentum, which we put in coming, P, Q, K. And we choose that each time we have such an interaction, the vertex that we have to put impose that the conservation of that the sum of these three momenta P O plus Q O plus K is equal to zero. So the interaction essentially is built up of this conservation rule big K, which depends on the small momenta of the world line at the point zero. Okay, where zero is the interaction. Zero is the proper time. Let's say the origin in the proper time of the particles meeting at the origin. And then we have to introduce a Lagrange multiplier Z, which impose when we vary Z, that imposes conservation law. So it cannot be something simpler than that. What we're going to see is that so Z is the Lagrange multiplier from the point of view of the action. But in fact, it also is going to be interpretable as the position of the interaction. And we are going to refer to this Z as the interaction coordinate. Whereas we are referring to the part to the coordinate conjugated to K as the particle coordinate. There's a question here?
Yes.
Yes. It's just a technical question that says that. Okay. Okay. Next slide. So we haven't explored yet all the equations of motion that we could. Because when we vary k, there's two terms. When we vary k, there's one term that is the bulk equation of motion that tells us that x dot is essentially proportional to k in Riemann normal coordinates. But there's also a boundary term that arrives here. And when we vary the boundary value of k, we get contribution coming from the interaction. So if we put together what equation of motion we get a relationship now between the particle coordinate, which is conjugated to the momentum k, and the interaction coordinate, which is introduced as the Lagrange multiplier. And we get this fundamental relation that xa at the point of interaction is essentially given by z, but there's an operator that is acting on z, which is the derivative of the conservation rule with respect to the momentum of the particle, which is conjugated to x. So now, if the conservation rule is non-linear, so that is, if the conservation rule, it's just not a linear function of k, but has higher order operators. So for instance, you know, it starts as k, but then there is a higher order object which involves the connection. Then we see that this relationship now essentially tells us that xj is going to be equal to z, xa is going to be equal to z. But then, you know, there's extra momentum dependent factors that enter this relationship. So what it's telling us is that in the case this interaction is nonlinear, all the x, which are all the positions of the particle, which are all the particle coordinates, are not going to be coincident when z is different from zero. So the non-coincidence is going to be momentum dependent. So what we can also see from this relation is that if z is equal to zero, that is, if I look at the observer is local to the interaction, if it's sitting at the point z equal to zero, then all the x's are equal to zero. So the interaction is local for an observer at the origin. But now, if an observer is not at the origin, there is some kind of dispersion. That is, different x are not going to be equal to each other. And they are going to be essentially the difference between different x is going to be proportional to the distance of the observer z times the connection coefficient, torsion or non-metricity, times the momentum. And this is in that sense that locality is relative. Observer local to the interaction sees the interaction as local, but observer distance from the interaction sees the interaction as non-local. Next slide. So let's dwell a bit more on this relationship. The relationship we have is that x, the particle coordinate, is related to z, the interaction coordinate with an operator that I call uk of ab, that has a tensor index. And this operator uk is essentially the derivative of the conservation rule with respect to momentum at the place where the conservation rule is equal to zero. And if we go back to what we were saying about addition and geometry, we can see that in fact this definition of derivative of a conservation rule at the point where the conservation rule vanishes can be effectively interpreted as a parallel transport operator. So the equation x equals zu is an equation, moreover, before I finish, moreover, we can see that xa is a particle which is conjugated to the momentum k. And geometrically, it's a particle that lives in a cotangent plane above the point k. Now, z is a particle which is conjugated to, in fact, the conservation rule, which is zero. So z is a particle that lives in the cotangent plane around the identity. So the relationship we're writing here is, in fact, very natural, because it says that on one hand, we have a covector living at k, x, and then we have a covector living at zero, p, and we want to relate them. And of course, in order to relate them, we need to use a parallel transport operator, which is given by the derivative of the conservation rule. And this is what the equation expressed, that the particle coordinate is essentially related to the interaction coordinate, but using the parallel transport operator. And in fact, in our setting, this type of relation is very natural, because if we try to think about what would be space-time, then space-time has to be the cotangent plane of momentum space. But if momentum space is curved, then different points of momentum space have different cotangent plane. And in order to compare them, we need to use this notion of parallel transport. So this is in that sense that observers with different energy have a notion of localization that lives in different cotangent planes. And in order to compare them, we need to parallel transport to the same place. Here, you know, the identity. So this is what the drawing is expressing, that we have a point zero, we have a point k, above k, we have a cotangent plane, which is the space-time seized by the particle. And then above zero, we have a cotangent plane, which is the space-time seized by the interaction. And then, of course, we have to parallel transport them in order to have a relationship between the two. So this expressed the fact that, in fact, there's no canonical projection from phase space to space-time. We cannot write globally that T star of P is M, some notion of manifold times P. So the notion of space-time, which is the existence of a canonical projection from momentum space, no longer exists here. We need to use, in some sense, some type of parallel transport using momentum coordinates in order to define what we would be calling space-time. Okay, next slide. And I hope this is clear. There are questions so that this is an important relationship. So here I'm... So if I look at this relation x equals zu, we see that when the conservation law is linear, then this parallel transport mu is just the identity. Of course, if the momentum space is flat, then all the cotangent planes are just the same objects, and parallel transporting from one to another is just the identity. In that case, If U is the identity, then this relationship just tells us that the particle coordinates x, I are exactly equal to this z. So all the particles are always, you know, the interaction for all the particles is exactly taking place at the same point. So the interaction is local, and this is what I was promising. I would show you that in some sense, you know, the notion of absolute locality is related to the fact that the momentum space is linear. Now, if the conservation law is nonlinear, as I say, then the interaction is only relatively local. That is, z equal to zero only if, or x equal to zero only if z equal to zero. There's a typo here. The last remark is that if we look at this relationship, x is a commuting coordinate with respect to the Poisson bracket, because it's a canonical coordinate. But now z is related to x by some operator that depends on the momentum. And in fact, because of that, it becomes a non-commutative coordinate. So you can think of that as some kind of covector field, which is covariantly constant on the manifold. But if we try to define it like that, then it becomes a non-commutative coordinate. And in fact, computing the Poisson bracket of z with itself, we find that the first term, which is proportional to z, measures the torsion. So if there is torsion, you know, I'm going to have a non-commutative manifold. And then if there is curvature, there is an extra term which is essentially proportional to the curvature times the angular momentum, p, the antisymmetric part of p times z. Okay. So this is to say that it would be natural in this setting to try to say that the cotangent plane at zero is what we would call the manifold where where physics takes place, the space-time where physics takes place. But if we try to do that, then the price to pay is that we have to deal with the notion of a non-commutative manifold. If we don't want to do that and want to deal with usual manifold, we have to just accept the fact that, you know, there's no universal space-time, and space-time is just, you know, different cotangent planes. Next slide. So this is just, you know, a picture that emphasizes again this relationship that, of the picture we are having here. We have, world lines meeting at a vertex, and if z is equal to zero, that is, if I'm an observer which is local to the interaction, then the interaction looks local. So there's no contradiction there. However, if now I'm displaced from the interaction, I'm a distant observer from the interaction, and the interaction is going to look to me like the right-hand side pictures, and x1, you know, x2, x3, and x4 are going to be displaced from that by an amount which is given by this parallel transport operator. And in fact, another way to see that is that, when we have a notion of conservation rule, we have a notion of translation in space-time. And in fact, the notion of translation in space-time is just conjugated by the Poisson bracket to the conservation rule. So we can use the conservation rule to translate the coordinates from, let's say, the origin, z equals zero, to a distant observer. This is what the equation in the bottom expressed. If we do that, we find that, in fact, different coordinates are displaced differently depending on their momentum. So there's a first term which is just b, but there's an extra term which involves the connection and b. So if we were trying to start from the left picture of a local observer and translating this local observer to a distant observer, we will see that the different x are translated by different amounts depending on their energy. And this is why we get this picture. Okay, next slide. So now that we have a dynamical model, one thing we can do is to try to specialize a bit the geometry. As I said, you know, the physics of this theory is going to be characterized by what is the non-metricity tensor, what is the torsion tensor, what is the curvature tensor. And so it's possible to restrict this subject very strongly by assuming a certain number of simple principles. So the first one is the correspondence principle, is that, and we already have used that principle, the fact that special relativity describes accurately all phenomena involving momenta smaller than the mass scale, m. And this mass scale is thought to be, you know, the Planck scale, but in fact it has to be determined experimentally. And this means that the torsion has to be of order 1 over m, and the curvature has to be of order 1 over m squared. This is to explain that, in fact, we don't observe at low energy this type of momentum, and we recover the usual notion of space-time and Riemannian geometry. Another principle is the fact, something we call the dual equivalence principle, which is the postulate that the aerograph interaction is independent of the nature of the particle, it's dependent on the color and the charge of the particle. So the geometry of momentum space is universal. If we push that to the point and we analyze what it means for identical particles, then it essentially points towards the fact that the addition momenta or the connection has to be torsionless if we don't modify the statistics of particles. And then we can go on a bit more and ask for a maximal symmetry. They ask that the structures and the geometry of momentum space has as many symmetries as flat space-time. This implies two things. It's going to imply that the connection has to be metric. So not only the torsion will vanish in the simple model, but the connection, the non-metricity will vanish. And the only geometry that has this maximal symmetry are going to be a curve manifold of anti-Decito type, or Decito type, which are parameterized by just the radius of curvature. And the radius of curvature in momentum space is essentially this mass scale, the Planck mass, or the one we determine experimentally. So if we take this principle at n, then we can restrict the geometry of momentum space to be non-metrical, torsionless, with the curvature, and the goal is to measure this curvature momentum space. However, here, this is a theorist argument, and the theorist proposed that experiment decides. So, next slide. So, the philosophy behind our work here is that the geometry of momentum space, we don't want to assume the geometry of momentum space. We think that geometry of momentum space is something that we should go out, look for, and measure experimentally, and determine experimentally. And if we take this point of view and keep an open mind on what the geometry of momentum space could be, then there's two sets of questions open up, some which are more theoretical and some which are purely phenomenological. So we can either take this restricted hypothesis and study the maximally symmetric model and find a clean measure of the dual cosmological constant. This is one type of study we're pursuing. But we can also be more phenomenologist and say, well, we have to design experiments that measure every single observable in the theory, and we have to be able to measure the torsion of the theory. We have to be able to measure the non-metricity of the theory. We have to be able to measure the curvature of the manifold and test this maximal symmetry principle, like Lorentz invariant or homogeneity in momentum space. Okay, so this next slide. This leads us to the questions of, okay, what type of experiment we can design in order to test the geometry of momentum space. And here I want to pause for a moment before giving you two examples that we are thinking about. But generally, there's some kind of opportunity here, because it's always thought that quantum gravity is in some sense experimentally contestable, because the Planck scale and the length scale are extremely small, and no usual experiments are going to be able to, see such small scales. There's a vast desert between the scale the LHC is turning on and the Planck scale, and there's no way we can bridge the gap there. So that's the usual, let's say, belief in particle physics, in most of the theoretical physics community. But now, the new twist here is that if we relax the notion of locality, what we're doing is that we're proposing a whole new area of extremely surprising phenomena that are not usually described in usual quantum theory or GR or any other theory. So there's an opportunity that, in fact, even if the scale is very small, the type of effect we're looking for, relative locality effect, are so unusual that we can get a signature of that. Okay, and that's the main idea. I think behind this proposal is that it gives us a tremendous opportunity to have a window onto quantum gravity physics. If it turns out that this is really what's realized, the quantum gravity, you know, turns momentum space into a nonlinear manifold in some limits. So one type of so that's a general comment. Another general comment is okay, what type of measurement are we going to be able to do in general, measuring the geometry of momentum space? And the idea, the general idea there is very simple, is that we are looking, you know, for observable momentum space. And the way to look to get observable momentum space, or to measure curvature or torsion momentum space, is to imagine forming a small loop in momentum space. And then seeing effects which are gathered around a phenomena which enclose a small loop in momentum space. This is really how we measure curvature. If we go back to this idea that, you know, absolute locality, for instance, is that the notion of space-time is independent on the color of the light we use, then if you think about, you know, two light rays that go from one point to another but have different energies, this process, you know, forms a little loop in momentum space. And in our context, we're going to have some kind of twin paradox, saying that the blue light and the red light don't see the same space-time. So the idea behind all the experiments we're proposing, and I'm just going to, you know, show only two of them, and this needs to be dwelt a bit more, are really this idea of twin paradox, so enclosing a loop in momentum space. So one analogy also, which in fact is inspired by an older work by Florian Girelli and Etera Livi, is the Thomas precession analogy. That is, if we have a loop in momentum space and we have a curvature which comes from this nonlinear addition, then if you have a system in revolution, like an electron, you know, orbiting an atom or a particle at the direction, this particle which encloses a loop in space, you know, as we think usually, also encloses a loop in momentum space at each period of revolution. Now, the thing is that the localization of the orbiting particle will be shifted in our context with respect to the particle at rest. That is, it's going to experience a boost which is going to be proportional to the curvature, and more explicitly, the boost is going to experience is going to be proportional to the area, delta A, the area enclosed by the loop in momentum space. So this is an area in momentum space measuring Planck units times the curvature times the momentum enclosed by the loop, or in fact times the mass of the particle which is running around the loop. And this means that at each at each orbit, you know, the particle experience some small displacement in space and time, which might, you know, is going to be a cumulative effect and might enable us to look for an enhancement of this extremely small effect. And as I emphasize, this is a very unusual and strange effect, because it's in some sense saying that the particle is able to pull itself by the bootstrap. Yeah. Next slide. Another key experiment that has a long history in the subject is the gamma ray experiment. So this is an experiment which is about localizing a distant object. That is, we have a star emitting very far away from us, emitting two photons of two different energies. And this is what the drawing represents. We have an atom in, and we emit a photon 1, which is a low energy photon. And then after a certain time, S, a proper time S, we emit a second photon T. And then, we are, an observer that receives the first photon, and then after another time S, receives the second photon of different energy. And in usual locality is that if the two photons 1 and 2 are emitted at the same time, well, they do arrive at the same time. And this is the kind of question we're going to look at. So so the question is whether, you know, two photons emitted at the same time for an observer, so at the same time means at the same time for an observer local to the star, is observed arriving at the same time for, you know, an observer for us. Okay. So it's important to remind us that if we use the Riemann normal coordinate, the speed of light is constant because the d square of p is just SID, PA, PD, the usual one. So the velocity here is not modified if we work in this coordinate. What we're going to use, however, is that in fact, to first order in this Riemann normal coordinate, the derivative of g is equal to zero, which means that essentially, if we work in this coordinate, the torsion has two components, a symmetric part and an anti-symmetric part. The anti-symmetric part is the torsion, and the symmetric part in this Riemann normal coordinate is essentially the non-metricity tensor. Okay, so next slide. Next slide is just saying that, in fact, we're going to see that even if the speed of light is the same, looks is the same, the two photons are not going to arrive at the same time. It's possible to see the two photons are not going to arrive at the same time. Next slide. So the setting is expressed in the little drawing below. That is, we have four, interactions, two emissions of photons by an atom or an electron there, and then the receptions of these two photons there. And then at each vertex, we have a particle coordinate, we have an interaction coordinate Z, and then we have the particle coordinate U. And the idea of the derivation is the one I was expressing before, is that we want to compute from two different perspectives the parallel, the transport, in some sense, from Z4 to Z2 to Z1, and then from Z4 to Z3 to Z1. So we want to compute from two different perspectives the parallel transport from one point of interaction to one point of reception to one point of emission. I'm not going to detail the computation, which is pretty technical, but essentially, if we denote by S2 the proper time elapsed between the arrival, the proper time seen by the observer between the arrival of the first photon and the arrival of the second photon, and S1, the proper time elapsed between the emission of the two photons, then we find that the difference S2 minus S1 is in fact proportional to gamma plus plus delta E, I'm sorry, there should be a time here, which is T2, which is the time of propagation between the between the emission and the reception. So there is an effect here which is due to non-metricity, because this is the symmetric part of the connection that enters this equation. And it means that if S1 is equal to zero, that is, even if the photons are emitted at the same time, then S2 are not going to be equal to zero. And this effect of S2 not being equal to zero is proportional to difference in energy, but also to the time elapsed between the emission and the reception. And I'm sorry for the typo here. There should be a time elapsed. So this is an effect which grows with the distance. This is the type of effect that we're going to witness with relative locality. If the connection is metric, so this shows that in fact, non-metricity will manifest itself in such a type of effects, that photons emitted at the same time are going to be received at the same time. And this is something that can be effectively bounded. There is some bound on the value of the non-metricity coming from actual experiments today. Now, if the connection is metric, that is, if the non-metricity tensor is zero, then there's no time delay. That is, delta S is equal to zero. If the photons are emitted at the same time, they arrive at the same time. But what happens is that these two photons, which have different energy, are going to appear to the observer coming from different locations. So the observer is going to receive these two photons at the same time, and then he's going to see these two photons coming from different locations. And in fact, the angle is also proportional to the torsion times the difference in energy times the time elapsed between the emission and the reception. There's some kind of dual gravitational lensing due to the torsion effect here. So this is also something that, you know, can be looked for and hasn't been really looked for yet. Next slide. And I guess I'm slightly over time, so I'm just going to mention that very, very briefly. It's a fundamental question that comes often when we talk about this modification of addition of momenta. That is, we have introduced a nonlinear addition rule with a Planck scale, you know, with a scale which is the Planck scale here. But one question that comes very naturally is to say, well, if we modify the law of addition of momenta with a scale MP, which is the Planck scale, how come we haven't witnessed that a modification of additional momenta when we use soccer balls, because soccer balls are objects, are microscopical objects, which have masses which are way above the Planck mass. And then this nonlinear modification, which is small for elementary particles, is not going to be small for soccer balls if the modification that enters the addition rule for soccer ball is the Planck scale. You know, how come this argument, you know, doesn't rule out this proposal right away, that we cannot modify the geometry of momentum space. And there's a very simple and very natural resolution of this problem, which is called the soccer ball problem. It is the fact that, in fact, the effective mass scale for the interactions of soccer balls, that is, the effective mass scale for the interactions of macroscopical systems, is if the macroscopical system is of size n, contains n atoms, or if the interactions involve n photons, the effective mass scale that enters the addition of momenta is not the Planck mass, but it's n times the Planck mass. So in the thermodynamic limit where n goes to infinity, you know, we recover the addition rule is effectively renormalized to be just the usual linear addition rule, and this is why we witness linear addition rule. Next slide. So the next slide is the detailed argument, or a more detailed argument for why this is true. But given the time, I think I just should conclude. So next slide, in the conclusion slide. So what we have shown here is that there's a new framework in which we can relax in a very controlled manner the notion of absolute locality, which is a fundamental of apodosis of physics. In this framework, momentum space is postulated to have a non-trivial geometry. It has a metric, it has a connection, it has non-metricity, torsion, and curvature. And this non-trivial geometry can, as we have demonstrated, and should be probed experimentally. Now, under general physical principle, a proof of class of momentum space can be proposed, which is the maximally symmetric one. There is many interesting and extremely surprising experimental consequences of having a non-trivial geometry of momentum space, and that's an opportunity of looking into the physics of quantum gravity. There is also, as I just brought around, interesting new mathematics. That is, here we have seen that in order to develop this structure, we have to develop a deep connection between algebra, composition rule, addition, and geometry, the notion of motion. And in some sense, this framework allows us to have some kind of you know, common mathematical language that mix together the notion of algebra and the notion of geometry. And very importantly, there's no soccer ball problem that allows to rule out this type of proposal right away. And of course, you know, it can be the case that momentum space has no non-trivial geometry, and then when we go around and measure it, torsion is zero, curvature is zero, and non-metricity is zero. But let's see. Thank you very much.
Questions?
Hi, this is Alex Borici. I have some questions. The first is a comment that all this structure you were defining
we did parallel transports and so on in space, momentum space, seems very much similar to what one does on Lie groups. So the question is if you do recover this case in when these assumptions of maximal symmetry. And the second question is that you seem to be putting a lot of importance to this origin space in momentum, but at the end, all these systems are bounded by or are determined by the constraint, which tells us that basically one has to restrict to the mass shell, which by itself introduces the mass scale and also some curvature on the space of momentum. So why do we have to pay so much attention to what happens at the origin of momentum space? Thanks.
Okay, so sorry, the first question is about the Lie group. Yes, so the Lie group, that's a very good question, and I do not have time to comment on that. So, of course, Lie group is part of this structure. So to assume that the curvature of momentum space is a Lie group, it means that the rule of addition is going to be associative. Okay, so if we take our setting and we assume that the rule of addition is going to be associative, then we have a Lie group in our context. So if we have a Lie group, then we follow the general mathematical structure I described, and it means that on the Lie group we have a preferred connection which is flat. Okay, and in fact it's known as the Cartan connection because associativity is related to curvature. So it means that if we take the hypothesis that momentum space is a Lie group, then the connection we are having there is a connection which is flat. It's a connection which is, in fact, torsion-full. It has a full. So what happens in a Lie group is that on a Lie group you have a metric. Okay. So this connection and the metric, has itself a metric connection, but the Cartan connection, which is the flat connection, is non-metrical, and it's possible in Lie groups to trade off the metricity of the connection with the torsion. So you can either have on the Lie group you can either use the metrical connection, which will be symmetric, or you can use the flat connection, the Cartan connection. And the Cartan connection is essentially the one that is defined by saying that left invariant vector fields are parallel transported. So does that answer your question?
Yes. And what is the relation then with the maximal symmetric case you have?
Well, the maximal symmetric case will be different because you see the thing is that the Cartan connection is non-metrical, and if you have non-metricity, you're breaking the symmetry. So, the Lie group case is in fact what people have studied the most before. That is, people are studying what's called kappa Poincaré, and kappa Poincaré has a co-product, which is an associative rule of additional momenta. And because of that, it amounts to have to put the notion of Lie group. So the maximally symmetric case has to be, so the maximally symmetric case I was describing has to be metrical and torsionless. So, and it has to carry curvature. So it's not, it means that the rule of composition has to be non-associative. So this is another, different realization.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Now, concerning the identity, I agree with you that if I look at single particle case, which is what you were referring to, there's no preferred notion of zero, or identity in momentum space. But the notion of identity in momentum space comes in when you start to talk about addition. That is, in energy momentum space, there is something which is the identity in the sense that if I add this zero momenta to another momenta, nothing happens. So it's really when I talk about the rule of compositional momenta that there is this special point. And in fact, the whole idea behind this framework comes back to Born, in fact, 1903. I mean, Born was the one that presented the problem in quantum gravity in completely new light, saying, well, okay, in quantum mechanics, you know, we have space and momentum space, and we have the Bohm reciprocity rule, which is that it doesn't matter which one you use to describe physics, you can use wave functions even if it's on space or momentum space, and physics is equivalent or independent of these descriptions. So space and momentum space are totally equivalent by canonical transformation. But now general relativity says, no, stop it, that's not true. You know, momentum space is very different than space because space has to be curved by gravity and momentum space has to stay flat, the cotangent bundle. And you know, Bohm say, well, we should be able to reestablish the duality between the two, between space and momentum space. And the only way we could do that is by allowing momentum space to also be curved, if we allow space to be curved. And that is, you know, the place where, so this is somehow the deep motivation behind this type of work, that quantum gravity, we hope, or we think, you know, is going in some way to reestablish the Bohm rule correspondence between space and momentum space, and by doing that, is going to curve momentum space. The only thing when you have this argument, the only place where people complain about the duality between space and momentum space is exactly the fact that space-time has no preferred origin, whereas momentum space do have a preferred origin, which is the vacuum. Okay, so there is in momentum space a preferred origin in motion space time. Okay, I hope it answers your question.
Yeah, partially because that works. We have, for instance, two particles, but then we think of in the standard space time picture as the two particles living on a space time, and then we can add them up the momentum and get zero. But if we think strictly in terms of phase space, then we have everything doubled, in the sense that they're living on different, on a higher dimensional space. So how do we see then this origin?
From the point of view of phase space.
Yeah, which is what you were in your motivation, the initial motivation, you wanted to tell us that the fundamental thing is phase space.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the origin is viewed by, in some sense, is going to be viewed by the Hamiltonian of the theory, right? This is where it's really a zero-point energy. So it's really going to be, it's really when you put the dynamics into the origin. So I agree with you that space by itself doesn't have a, you know, the structure.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay.
More questions?
There's a question here.
Hi, my name is Willem Wester, and I had a question whether you envision some kind of Einstein's equations in momentum space. Then start from there, and then work back through canonical transformations to position equations.
Okay. Well, you know, that's the million-dollar question. I don't know at this stage. Of course, here, you know, we're taking a fundamental point of view where we say that momentum space has to be the geometry of momentum space has to be experimentally explored, and we gave some motivation from quantum gravity by the fact that there's a mass scale entry. Another motivation for me is the fact that, in fact, in 2 plus 1 quantum gravity, you know, we showed that this is exactly what happened. The way 2 plus 1 quantum gravity works and resolves the Bohm paradox is by curving momentum space. So we have at least one example where quantum gravity does that. But generally speaking, of course, we haven't given, you know, the reason why momentum space is curved. What is the source of curvature in momentum space? We hope that it's related to some, you know, curvature in space-time when we turn out into Newton, but so at the end of the day, yes, we want first to study, it's already weird enough to work in a place, to do physics in a place where space-time no longer exists. So we want to spend some time there without G Newton. But then there's the big question behind what happens when we turn G Newton on. And what this type of work gives us is that it gives us something which is a new perspective on how to ask the question of quantum gravity. Along this line, you know, what could be the source of curvature of momentum space, and how this is related to gravity or quantum gravity. But at this stage, no, we have absolutely No idea.
More questions?
Okay, everything was clear.
Okay, let's thank Laurent again.